This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It has been interesting that the oil and gas industry has been able, through the political process over the last decades, to be exempted from many of our environmental laws.
The potential damage posed by hydraulic fracturing or fracking to groundwater, its contribution to earthquake risk, and overall deceptive practices by the industry have all been exposed through science and good journalism. Today on Sea Change Radio, we explore aspects of fracking that may be less known. This week's guest is Caroline Cox, the research director for the Center for Environmental Health, who recently co-authored an important study tracking the air pollution associated with this controversial extraction process. We talk about the study's methods, findings, and what it may mean moving forward. Then we revisit my interview with Jaya Lee and James West of Mother Jones and their profile of the burgeoning fracking industry in China. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Caroline Cox. She's the research director for the Center for Environmental Health. Caroline, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So this fall, you and your colleagues published a study chronicling and documenting air pollution risks from fracking. Why don't you first explain the coalition that came together to come out with this study, and then we'll dive into the findings.
So the study was coordinated by a national coalition called the Coming Clean Collaborative, and it involved community groups in five different states. The community groups were people from communities where fracking was taking place, and the people in those community groups were trained to collect air samples, so that this is in the jargon for it is community-based participatory research. But what it means is that the people who live in the area, who have that kind of intimate understanding of what's going on because it's their home, they're the ones who are actually driving the study and collecting the samples. And then there was a independent lab that analyzed those samples for toxic chemicals, and then co-authorship between people who had scientific background and the community members to publish this study. And there's also a sort of a more kind of user-friendly report that was published at the same time, talks about the same air monitoring data, but has more stories from the community members about what it was like to live in this environment.
Now, I want you to outline some of the findings, but one of the first things that came to mind was, what range were you sampling? Are we talking about the potential risks to people who are either living right next to a fracking site or the workers, or is this a general population risk, or in your estimation?
Most of the samples were taken not farther away than 500 meters from the locations where the activity was going on, was taking place. So in many cases, these oil and gas operations actually occur right near somebody's home or across the street from somebody's home or near a school, whatever. So yes, we did look at close distances, but they're not so close as to be unrealistic.
Now, most of the studies that our listeners would be aware of have centered around water pollution. Namely, a lot of our listeners are familiar with Gasland and Gasland 2. Josh Fox and his team have shown some pretty shocking footage of water being lit on fire coming out from faucets. But we don't think about the air pollution that might be caused by this. Why don't you first outline then some of the findings?
In general, I think it is true that people have thought more about water pollution connected with fracking than air pollution. But this study, because it involved multiple samples from multiple communities in five states, it actually took quite a while to actually get it started and then finished. During the time in which the study was underway, there was a lot more information collected and made public about air pollution connected with fracking. So I think you're absolutely right, especially when we started the study, that people were thinking more about water. But I think there was a change in the last couple of years to where people have started thinking about air as well.
And what should people know about the air pollution risks that hydraulic fracturing may or may not cause?
So one thing that I think is really important to know is that there's a lot of information about fracking that's not publicly available. And oftentimes we don't know what chemicals are being used or what chemicals are being emitted. And so that makes it hard to do air monitoring, because one of the first questions is, well, what chemicals are we going to look for? And if you don't really know, it's tough to answer that question. So in this study, we used kind of a standard screen for what are called volatile organic compounds. Those are chemicals that evaporate into the air easily, and so would be something that you might expect to find. And then we also did a separate kind of monitoring for formaldehyde, which is something that's often produced when there's some kind of like combustion going on. So we found formaldehyde often in compressor stations. Those are big, essentially big pumps that move gas through pipelines. The other chemicals that we found at high levels, in addition to formaldehyde, were benzene, which is a chemical that's been identified for a long time as a cancer-causing chemical. And also, in some locations, we found a lot of hydrogen sulfide. And that's a chemical that is, it's hard on your lungs if you breathe it, and if you breathe enough of it, it's fatal.
And that's also one of the ingredients that people who've been monitoring water tables are looking for as well, as benzene levels, correct?
Right, because benzene, while it is a volatile organic compound and does, evaporate into the air, has also been found as a water pollutant as well.
Caroline, you mentioned how so little is known about the chemicals that go into the fracking process. How did you and your team go about trying to detect the carcinogens and the pollutants that were being used in these processes? Was it proactive, saying, all right, let's test for benzene? Or is the technology at a place where it can just tell you there's benzene in the air?
There are some very, very expensive and high-tech instruments that, you know, sort of give you the ability to sort of look at, well, what's there? Tell us what's there. But most standard laboratory analysis, you have to know what to look for. And so in this case, there's a standard analysis that's been used by EPA for many, many years. That's just a screen of common volatile organic compounds. So that's what we did with our samples. And then we did some additional analyses to look for formaldehyde, like I mentioned before, and also for methane, which is actually what natural gas is primarily made of. So we looked for those different things. And honestly, we know that we missed a lot, because we tested for maybe 60 different chemicals altogether. And, you know, there's literally thousands of chemicals that we might have tested for.
Sure. So what does the industry put out? And then let's turn to how state and federal laws may be able to steer this industry into cleaning its act up.
So I think industry has several arguments, and I'm not that good at stating their arguments, but one thing that I think has been an important issue is that, you know, for many, many years, the U.S. depended on importing fossil fuels for all the different things that, you know, we use fossil fuels for, including transportation, production of electricity, heating our homes. You know, we use fossil fuels in many, many different ways. And so we were importing that fossil fuel from other countries. And, you know, this really put the U.S. in a difficult position politically, because many of the countries that were providing us with fossil fuels had political and other problems. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that, but there, you know, one of the things that industry has said over and over again is that now we've developed this U.S. source of fossil fuels so that we are no longer dependent on importing oil or gas.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the research director of the Center for Environmental Health, Caroline Cox. Caroline, maybe you can outline the tools that EPA has to enforce pollution caused by the natural gas industry on a federal level, and also what the states might be able to do about the problem.
I should say that I'm more of a scientist and, you know, don't have a whole lot of legal expertise. So you should take everything that I say with a grain of salt. But it has been interesting that the oil and gas industry has been able, through the political process over the last decades, to be exempted from many of our environmental laws. So we don't have the same health protections that we would from other industries. And it's been harder to protect our air and our water. So I mentioned earlier that in conjunction with the scientific publication, there was also a report that was designed for a more general audience and also particularly like policymakers. And it also had a series of recommendations about what should happen. So one sort of overarching thing was, let's use a precautionary approach. Let's not, you know, sort of wait till people are sick and then do something about it, but let's take health protective measures early. Another thing that is probably really obvious to everybody is that we need clean energy and we need energy efficiency. And the more that we invest in those things, the less that we're going to need to do oil and gas development, whether that's here in this country or elsewhere. And then where oil and gas development is already happening, what we recommend is that there's more monitoring so that we'll have more data about what the problems actually are. And we really recommend that that monitoring be done by the communities that are impacted for those communities, because that's how you're going to get the best results. And then for the companies that are doing oil and gas development, they need to identify the chemicals that they're using, because we really can't safeguard public health if we don't know what we're talking about. And a lot of times in the regulatory process, there's protection for companies, confidential business information. We really think that needs to be shifted so that there's more right to know by the people who are exposed. And in particular, one group of people who really need to know what's going on are our doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers, because they can't treat patients if they don't know what those patients are being exposed to.
Are there any studies that give us a better idea about workers in the oil and gas industry and any lung disease or any other red flags that would corroborate some of your findings?
Well, one thing that I know OSHA has been really concerned about, OSHA is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and that would be the federal agency whose job it is to look for, you know, worker health and safety. One thing that they've been really concerned about is there's a lot of sand used in the fracking process. Basically, fracking involves injecting a mixture of chemicals down on an oil or gas well and sort of opening up the cracks. And then part of that mixture of chemicals is sand, and that sort of keeps the cracks open so that the oil or gas can be pumped out. And if there's a lot of sand in the air, especially small particles of sand, those particles are referred to as crystalline silica, and they are known to cause lung disease and lung cancer. And it, you know, depends on the size of the particles, but small particles that can get breathed down deep into your lungs are really a problem. And OSHA, you know, had done some sampling at sites where fracking was occurring and found really high levels of crystalline silica that was the right size, that it would be easily breathed into people's lungs. And they were concerned about that.
Maybe you can give us an idea of how fracking stacks up to some other fossil fuel industries, namely coal and more traditional oil extraction.
I think there's lots of evidence and lots of information about the problems connected with coal, and both for the workers who mine the coal and for communities where coal is being burned. And I don't think anybody's suggesting that we go back to burning more coal. In terms of oil and gas, I think there's a whole lot of variability depending on the particular circumstances involving the, you know, the geological formation from which these things are extracted. Here in California, there's a statewide commitment to go to low-carbon fuels. And part of that is because a lot of the oil that's produced here in California is very energy intensive in its production methods. So that makes it a really high carbon fuel, because you have to basically use so much fuel in order to produce the fuel, if that makes any sense.
Sure. And water, I know, is a big resource that's being taxed in oil and gas extraction as well.
Right. And with, you know, with natural gas, it doesn't produce the quantities of carbon dioxide when we use it that, say, for example, a coal plant would. And carbon dioxide is, you know, one of those things that we're really concerned about in terms of global warming. But methane itself is a very potent greenhouse gas. So if we are doing oil and gas development and there is methane, the gas, escaping into the atmosphere because there are leaks or whatever, that can actually really change the equation in terms of how we're impacting climate change. So it's really complicated. There aren't any simple answers. I think going back to actual renewable sources of energy and energy efficiency is, you know, where the answers are really going to come in the long term.
Well, it's great work that you're doing, and folks can find it on ceh.org, and we'll link to it also at Sea Change Radio. Caroline Cox, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wondering where it will go. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wondering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right. Where I belong, I'm right. Where I belong. Well, silly people, they standing there, they disagree, they never will.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now let's revisit a discussion I had a few months back with James West and Jaya Lee of Mother Jones. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jaya Lee and James West. They both work for Mother Jones, and they have a recent piece entitled Deep Inside the Wild World of China's Fracking Boom. Jaya, James, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So in terms of natural gas and shale deposits, what kind of proven reserves is China reporting at this point to the global community? Is this akin to the U.S. deposits or not?
So according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, who have kind of forecasted deposit volumes around the world, China has the highest volume and surpasses that of the U.S.'s own resources. There's a bit of debate as to how much of that is economically viable in terms of extraction and how much of it they'll physically be able to access in China. Here in the U.S., we see a lot of extraction happening in flatlands. In China, the geology is very different. It's in very mountainous areas, and the geology of the shale formations is much more complicated than those that we've seen here in the States. So the actual... You know, it really depends on how you're defining reserves here in the U.S. and in China. The potential, though, is seen to be pretty great. How much of that in reality will be extracted, it's hard to say at this point.
From your piece, it sounds like a lot of the shale deposits are a little more harder to get. This is not the easy oil, so to speak. There's going to be tremendous amount of water used to try to extract these deposits, and that leads to one of the big resource concerns.
Right, exactly. So there are multiple aspects to the challenges that China faces in terms of developing its shale gas reserves. The foremost one, as both industry folks and environmental researchers see it, is the water, amount of water required to drill for shale gas. Some early estimates say that it's roughly twice that of what's required here in the U.S. But that's not the only challenge, right? As I was just saying, the road infrastructure getting to some of these very, very remote areas high up in the mountains is going to be logistically very challenging, and I think has already proven to be so at China's early fracking wells. Nonetheless, the Chinese government, and with encouragement from the U.S. government, still sees a lot of potential in this realm, and I think we'll continue to see companies at least attempting to extract, even with these challenges at hand.
James, maybe you can speak to the evolution or the run-up to where we are now in terms of multinational corporations based largely in the U.S., these oil and gas interests like Halliburton and the ExxonMobils of the world, and China. Can you paint us a picture of what's been happening for the last 4 or 5 years? China Air has direct flights now from Beijing to Houston, which I found pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the relationship between China and the U.S. in terms of oil and gas cooperation at some of the highest levels of bilateral arrangements has been going for a couple of years now. But it's only very recently that the focus has turned to fracking as a potential technique to unlock these massive shale reserves that Jaya was talking about before. And so we got really kind of amazing exclusive access to one of these conferences where we saw top-level officials from the United States government talk to their counterparts and introduce some of these senior-level executives from these big companies that you were mentioning, you know, this sort of presenting a platter of American, corporate interest for the Chinese to grill about how it could be that they could frack these massive shale reserves. So we had a good insight into that and heard from the then ambassador to China, Gary Locke, really prioritize, it seemed to me, fracking as one way that China can really begin to think seriously about their air quality crisis, as well as climate change, which he mentioned specifically in front of all of these delegates to this conference in a city called Xi'an in the center of China.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jaya Lee and James West of Mother Jones. They have a piece in the recent Mother Jones issue on China and its fracking boom. So one of the takeaways that your piece reflected was that the talking points from these executives that you're referring to, James, were saying we got to get China off coal, and this is the best way. Obviously, these are not like the staunchest environmentalists, but what are their motives beyond just dollars? Do you think that there is some validity to looking at natural gas as a bridge for the Chinese with their seemingly endless demand for more and more energy at this point?
I think what you can say is that China is trying absolutely everything. You know, they're not just trying fracking as a bridge fuel to get off coal. They're also the world's leading investor in renewable energy, for example. And we also had the great fortune of touring a solar facility, the biggest in the world, operated by Yingli Solar outside of Beijing in a city called Baoding. So they're doing that as well. They're doing wind, they're doing solar. So I see this as part of a portfolio that they're trying to develop at a breakneck speed so that they can finally begin to transition off coal and they can finally see that peak, which the vice premier mentioned in front of the UN in New York the other day. He actually said that we may even be able to see as soon as possible, the peak of our emissions in the next decade. So that's a remarkable thing for the Chinese to begin to achieve. And I think fracking is certainly not being sold or marketed by the Chinese as a silver bullet, but it's being seen potentially as a way that they can begin to reduce their emissions, clean up their act, and have a reliable, you know, albeit still fossil fuel source of energy as part of a renewable portfolio that, you know, can begin to get rid of coal in the long term. But certainly from what we saw, we're so far away from that happening.
To hear the rest of my discussion with Jaya Lee and James West of Mother Jones, please visit the Sea Change Radio Archives.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lightning Rod, Dr. John, and the Wood Brothers. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.